ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A confession. A memory. A lie. What if all three could be wrong? Forensic is a new series from All in the Mind, unpacking the hidden psychology of crime solving. Why innocent people confess? How memories can be rewritten? The science behind true crime. All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. As his hospital in northern Gaza was being shelled by the IDF in late 2024, Dr. Hassam Abu Safia filmed its destruction. The footage went viral. So did a picture of him walking in his doctor's gown towards the tanks to beg them to stop slaughtering his patients. He was arrested. Despite a world campaign for his release, he's still in prison in Israel. Later, an update on the case of Dr. Safia. Translators of Shakespeare must change absolutely nothing, says Daniel Hahn, except all the words. Daniel Hahn is here for Sydney Writers Festival and will be joining us on the show a little later to talk about the pleasures and pitfalls of putting Shakespeare into any other tongue but English. But first, we showed heroic restraint last week, letting other voices on other shows exhaust themselves and many of you talking about the budget. We're committed on Late Night Live to letting dust settle, to perspective, and to giving others a chance to speak. They have, the people, that is, in a fascinating set of polls published over the weekend, which Anna Henderson joins us now to discuss. Anna, welcome.
Well, David, if it wasn't enough to just go through the process of reporting on the budget, to have such immediate feedback from the public and then to be poring over it over so many days that you've gotten to sit back and let it wash over you, I'll do my best to walk you through what I've learned, but I must stress that it has been a wall of information.
A wall of information that you know how to climb. Okay, now what do you make of what I see as rather perplexing poll results on the budget?
It is an extremely unusual set of circumstances, isn't it? So the government has broken a series of election promises. So it didn't get a mandate from the public to go forward with these changes to property taxes, you know, negative gearing, capital gains tax discount, and of course as well, the changes on trusts. But at the same time, the polling data has consistently shown, and even over the weekend, that there is, you know, quite strong support in the public for these changes to be made. That there's still a sense in the public that, you know, the government needed to do something on this, that the intergenerational inequity that the Prime Minister has identified was something that was quite popular to be dealt with. But yet when you get to the nitty-gritty of whether or not people are happy with the budget or not, well, it comes down to a fairly poor result for Labor. In fact, you know, it's been compared with budgets in years gone by as potentially one of the worst budget reactions for many decades. So it is an interesting conundrum that the government finds itself in as it does its, you know, roadshow it does every year to sell the budget, and just seems to find itself tied up a little more every day in a negative feedback loop.
But let's look at some of these figures. I mean, when asked about capital gains tax, this is in the Resolve strategic poll, which was published in the Nine newspapers. When asked, you know, are the changes to capital gains tax a good idea? Yes, 36%, no, 21%. That's strong endorsement. Same question about changes to negative gearing. Yes, 35%, no, 21%. Again, strong endorsement. According to the reports of the Resolve poll, They took people through 11 budget measures, and all of them were approved by people except for the stopping work on the Inland Rail, which was a dead heat between those who opposed and those who supported it. So the detail is approved of, and yet there is this strong sense that the budget isn't going to do anybody much good.
Well, if you think back towards sort of February this year when some of that polling was being done as well, asking the general question, because these are questions that the government has been asked many times over the past years, at what point would they potentially have to change tack and actually make the call that property taxes were the problem, or they were constricting housing supply, and that this was something that was preventing young people from buying a home. Back in February, you know, 2/3 of respondents backed changes to capital gains tax concession and negative gearing assistance. So there was very strong support earlier in the year. I do wonder whether one of the things that has made people less excited about this budget, more perhaps the actual response is more despondent about their economic situation, is that there hasn't been anything new in the budget to kind of give them more money in their pocket now. And there's a good reason for that, according to the government, which is that, you know, we're in an inflation cycle, an output inflation cycle, interest rate cycle as well. And so the government is trying to provide some relief. Like, there's, you know, a cut to the fuel excise that ends in June. There are other measures already in place to try and sort of buttress people's financial reality. But there's nothing that the budget has brought forward in the short term to say, we hear you, we're reacting, here's something for you, you know, now or very soon. There's this Working Australians tax offset, which actually hits the tax return in 2028. And that's a working framework now for the government to potentially increase that amount of money down the line. They're definitely very much kind of forward sizzling the likelihood that that could get higher. But it's nowhere near people's reality right now.
So everything is pushed, you know, back down the line. Nothing coming up soon. So they just, everybody is just soldiering on with what they've got.
It's hard to tell. And don't forget, there are other things. You know, we talked, I think, last week about the budget strategy. Labor very carefully and cleanly laying out day by day over a matter of weeks in the lead up to the budget those other big announcements, including the massive restrictions they're going to put into the National Disability Insurance Scheme funding to try and reduce that as a budget pressure, including the spending on defence, including other measures that they're taking. And it seemed like that strategy of bringing things out early was kind of making it seem like a reasoned, logical process. And yet when we've got to budget day, suddenly there's been this negativity in the reaction. And some of it has been kind of, I think, for the Prime Minister, unexpected, because things like the change to the capital gains tax discount, which has also been sold as something to do with the property market, but has also extended to assets. And it's also extended to the sort of startup and tech sector, for example. I don't know if you've seen the memes online that people have been creating over the week. They're sort of startup or they're, yeah, you know, small business, where they've superimposed the Prime Minister in there and said, just announcing sort of tongue in cheek, that we've got a new, you know, a new co-founder who owns 47% of this business. So obviously, you know, that's them saying suddenly we're being hit with this higher tax rate and we don't think it's fair. So that's the younger generational reaction that's different to the one the Prime Minister was certainly expecting and waiting on, which was young people trying to get into a house saying, oh, thankfully, finally, someone's done something to make this easier for us.
Isn't there some way of the Albanese government cutting through here and saying, look, we all have to pay tax? And, you know, even if you've set up a family trust, and the notion of the argument for taxing family trusts goes back decades. And this government has finally found the courage to say, we're going to tax family trusts. The result, people are saying, oh, it's death duties all over again. Well, most countries have death duties. It's how they pay for their armies and their schools. But here in Australia, that is seen as a fundamental violation.
The Prime Minister is a very astute politician on these kinds of decisions. You would expect, and you know, he's had a long career in Parliament. I think he always knew that there would be a backlash to going forward with this, despite not taking it to an election. And on that trust front, And, you know, the scare campaign, as the government's calling it, on death taxes. I mean, there is no change to deceased estates and fixed trusts. And it's this particular type of testamentary trust, a discretionary testamentary trust that is, you know, I think grandfathered, but it's into the future that is going to be affected. And it's the kind of trust which the government says should be covered by this. And in fact, there's only less than 10,000 examples of this in Australia now. So this is a very small portion of the decision, but the opposition has successfully managed to weaponize it as a death duty. And there are a number of people I've spoken to today, sort of who are experts in the tax area, who say, well, you could say it is a duty related to a death, but it's not one of the big ones that we're all aware of, you know, that's, you know, an inheritance tax on a broad scale. This is affecting a small number of people who could just move it into a fixed testamentary trust. But this is in the weeds, right? But, you know, you get the big headline, are we going to get death duties here? And the opposition is successfully kind of wielding that at the moment. And the government, as you say, David, now has the, I guess, you know, track laid out to try and unfold its cut-through message. But I think at the moment, it's not managing to sell this in the way that it was hoping to. But, you know, it's early days. We're a week out from the budget. We're 2 years from the election.
Maybe
I'm sure that's what the Prime Minister is thinking.
Maybe not all the dust has settled. But, Anna, do you love the word hurt appearing? You know, this is going to hurt small business, and it's going to hurt people with trusts, and it's going to hurt business in general. As if we're not just talking here about, you know, paying a few bills, but it's pain. It's the pain. And, of course, I'm also in love with the argument that to tax people is to destroy their aspirations. Are you across that? Can you understand that one?
Well, I think that the government was making some pretty big changes to systems that people not only use at the moment to build their wealth, but also aspirationally. Like, a lot of people I've spoken to over the past week about these changes, who I said, well, are you currently using any of these tax measures? So, not necessarily using them now, but in their kind of idea of what being in Australia and using the current systems to hopefully build wealth and build that kind of future they want, or that, you know, that, yeah, the wealth creation that they want to see, that's been an avenue that's been there for them to use. And now it's taken away.
Yeah.
And the older generation who already had access to it don't get taken off.
No,
that
it's
process.
Grandfathered.
It's still there for them. So I think that the opposition is successfully tapping into that. Tim Wilson, the shadow treasurer, has been quite effective in that over the past few days.
We're a strange country. We have always been so generous to the prosperous. But now the upshot of all of this is interesting. In the preferred Prime Minister figures that have been coming out of these polls as well. Now, there's a big variation between the polls, but a couple of them anyway are showing that Angus Taylor has become extraordinarily popular.
I do think it's interesting that Angus Taylor has managed to, at least in this polling reality, break through to name recognition, and also that he will be very buoyed by this personally. There's been a lot of concern within the opposition around whether or not he is cutting through, whether or not he is able to deliver the message, and even in the budget reply, whether or not his performance in the House of Representatives was really meeting the moment. But this will be, and I think we saw a spring in the opposition leader's step today when he was selling, you know, what he called the stinker of a budget, that he seems to be on a bit of a confidence run. So we'll see how that plays out for him internally, but also in terms of his ability to prosecute these really quite extraordinary policies, both when it comes to income tax and also when it comes to immigration.
Anna, thanks. I've been talking to Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent with SBS World News. Coming up, the fate of Gazan doctor Hassam Abu Safia. In its unsuccessful campaign to disarm Hamas, Israel has wrecked many or most of Gaza's hospitals and killed or captured hundreds of the doctors and nurses working in them. One of the captured is Dr. Hassam Abu Safia, who was the director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza, who refused to leave his patients one day in late December 2024 when the IDF bombarded the place, killing at least 30 people, then marching the staff out, stripped to their underwear. Dr. Safia posted film of all of this, which made him instantly a face of resistance in Gaza. He was taken into custody that day and has been behind bars ever since. There are allegations that he's been tortured. Dr. Safia is still detained by Israel after nearly 18 months. This has sparked outrage from UN experts, human rights organisations, and medical groups around the world demanding his release. Joining me now from Tel Aviv is Dr. Guy Shalev, CEO of Physicians for Human Rights Israel, which is an NGO dedicated to promoting health rights in Palestine and Israel. Welcome, Dr. Shalev, to Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me.
It was alleged by Israel that this hospital, the Kamal Adwan Hospital, had within it a command post for Hamas. Has any evidence for that been produced?
Unfortunately not. Even the Israeli military did not provide evidence. After they raided the entire hospital, they have it all under their control. They haven't provided evidence of any command center. They did show, they published a picture of some three or four rifles that they found in the hospital. Not something that you would consider a command center, but this needs to be understood in the broader context of Israel's allegation of hospitals in Gaza using as command centers. This is the argument that Israel is providing since 2009. And that is in order to justify the attack on these facilities. But 33 hospitals in Gaza were attacked by Israel. All of them were claimed to be command centers, but we haven't seen the evidence for that. And it is Israel's obligation to provide that evidence according to international humanitarian law.
The destruction of hospitals is, in international law, a crime, is it not?
Definitely. When you destroy a hospital, you don't only attack the wounded and sick people that are getting healthcare in there, not only attacking the staff that is working in there, but you're also creating a situation where an entire community, thousands and thousands of people whose health is dependent on this hospital, are in that moment stripped of their right to health. And then you see what we've seen in Gaza, more than 2 million people that are not getting the most basic health care, with medications and equipment not coming in, with doctors, as you said, killed or detained, with hospitals raided and bombed. You have cancer patients. For example, there is no cancer treatment in Gaza. So everyone with cancer in Gaza is just slowly deteriorating into death, basically. And that is why we say that the genocide hasn't ended with the ceasefire. People are still dying because of Israel's actions. Currently, there is not even one hospital in Gaza that is fully operative. And part of that is because of missing equipment, missing medications. Still, the humanitarian aid is not coming in as it's supposed to come. Stocks are supposed to be full. There is basically no reason to not have hospitals in full stock being able to care for the people. And that is definitely not the case. Other aspects are Israel's blocking off doctors coming in, international doctors coming in to support the Gaza healthcare system. Israel is blocking a lot of them. Israel is not allowing even a single Palestinian doctor from the West Bank or East Jerusalem to enter the strip in order to support the system. And Israel is blocking the evacuation of almost 20,000 patients that need urgent medical evacuation. Not even one patient was allowed to cross from Gaza to Palestinian hospitals in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. So all this together is a continuing attack on health and the people of Gaza.
What reason does Israel give for taking these measures?
It's not clear. We file petitions with the Israeli Supreme Court, basically also to get these responses, to understand what the logic is behind it, and then we can maybe attack that logic and try to change the policies. But the responses we are getting are just, these are security concerns. We don't have to share our reasons for not allowing that. With the case of medical evacuation, for example, Israel argues that it allows some medical evacuations to third countries. So flying people all the way to Indonesia with specific conditions, of course, is not something that's possible. And then you have people that can get treated in hospitals just 1 hour away with an ambulance drive, and Israel is blocking that. So we're not getting the responses that make any sense.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Dr. Guy Shalev from the NGO Physicians for Human Rights Israel. Guy, Dr. Abu Safia, I take it that as the hospital was being bombarded, he filmed what was going on with his phone.
Yeah, so Dr. Abu Safia was the reason why first of all, there are other doctors being held in Israel, 14 doctors, leading senior doctors that are still held in detention in Israel, and we are calling for the release of all of them, including Dr. Abu Safia. The reason Dr. Abu Safia is famous worldwide is first and foremost because he's such a senior pediatrician, and we know that children in Gaza desperately need pediatricians, and that's one thing. The other thing is, as a doctor, he testified to what's going on in Gaza, and with journalists, international journalists not allowed in, with Palestinian journalists getting targeted. In many cases, doctors were the only source of information coming out of Gaza. And between October and December 2024, when his hospital, Kamal Adwan Hospital, was under attack, he was sharing the information over Instagram, and many people worldwide followed his update. He sadly lost his son and had to bury him in the compound of the hospital during these attacks. So people know him, know his name, appreciated the information he got from him. And for 500 days now, he has basically disappeared. He's held in detention, and very little information is available about him.
Do you know where he is?
He's in a prison called Ziot in Israel, which is another, by the way, an illegal act to hold a person from an occupied territory within the territory of the occupying power. So that's part of the problem. He's held in a prison in Israel. He cannot get any family visits. He cannot have any phone calls. His only connection with the outside world is when he sees the lawyer that we send in order to see how he's doing and to provide some support, legal support. And then also these lawyer visits are canceled many times. So just to get to visit him, we finally were able to do that last week. After weeks and weeks, we're trying to send our lawyer to visit him. So even that only connection with the outside world is very much limited.
How is he?
Well, he's been held for, as I said, 500 days. He's lost weight. He's getting he's not getting the food, the enough food in order to be healthy. He has medical conditions that are not treated. He needs prescription glasses that he's not getting. So he's basically, he has to survive this way for a long time now. They have in their room, in their cell, one mattress, and then the prison guards take the mattress in the morning and only return it in the evening. So all day they're just stuck in the cell, sitting on a metal bed. These are conditions that are shared by other unlawfully held doctors and other Palestinians under the unlawful combatants law, which basically is a administrative detention that kind of allows Israel somehow to hold these people with no indictment, with no legal oversight. The ICRC is not getting access to see these people.
Sorry, what organization is that?
ICRC, sorry, the International Committee of the Red Cross. And that their mandate of the Red Cross is to be able to visit prisoners and evaluate their conditions. And Israel unlawfully is not allowing them access into prison.
So the Red Cross can't get into any prisons in Israel or Gaza or West Bank?
Yeah, well, 2.5 years now, yeah.
I understand that Amnesty has alleged that he has been tortured. Do you know about that?
We know that he and other Palestinian, what Israel defines as security prisoners, are held in torturous conditions. So they are being devoid of medical care. They're being devoid of their basic needs. And according to international law and international conventions, this amounts to torture. We don't yet, only when he'll be out and we'll be able to get his testimonies on what he went through, we don't yet have evidence of direct physical assault on him.
What's your organization, Human Rights Israel, able to do for him?
Not much. That's very sad. So what we can do is we appealed to the High Court in order to get him and the other 13 doctors out. And we are doing a lot of advocacy work around the world. We're trying to get people also in Australia to be involved. We want to get medical associations involved because these are doctors. These are their colleagues that are being held in these conditions. And we, if there are any doctors listening to this show, and I assume there are many, I would call them also to pressure the Australian Medical Association, to pressure the World Medical Association, and hold Israel accountable for these medical ethics violations that we see in Gaza and still see, and the treatment of doctors.
Tell us about the last image we have of this man, of Dr. Sophia.
That very, very famous image of Dr. Abu Sophia with his white robe, coming out to an Israeli tank in order to communicate to them who is in the hospital, the patients and their needs, and why attacking and raiding this hospital is going to cause a lot of harm and death. In fact, this is not the moment where he was detained, which is kind of a false convention in the world, thinking this is when he was detained. He was later allowed back in the hospital to talk to his staff members, to the patients, getting them ready, knowing that this is about to happen. And then when Israel raided the hospital, he was taken out, as you said, in their underwear, held in the cold for a few hours in one building. And then after they made some kind of, I don't know, selection, they decided who is going to be detained and who is not. And then he was detained. And ever since, he's been held.
Guy, why do you think Israel is doing this?
Well, that's a very difficult question. As an Israeli, I might say, this is just a part of dehumanization of Palestinians, destroying the healthcare system, at detaining doctors in such a way. It cannot be explained in any security concerns. This is an attack on civilians, on people, on children who need this treatment, on the elderly, on chronic disease, people with chronic diseases. I gotta say that I don't even try to understand the logic anymore. I just want the world to act and acknowledge that the Israel's logic in its action towards Palestinians is just, I don't know, it's just horrible and full of hatred and dehumanization. So someone needs to hold Israel accountable. So someone needs to stop the Israeli government from continuing these actions and demand accountability.
Guy, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Dr. Guy Shalev, who is the CEO of Physicians for Human Rights Israel, an NGO that's dedicated to promoting health rights both in Palestine and in Israel itself. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, the pleasures, the pitfalls of Shakespeare in translation. Shakespeare is performed almost anywhere on earth in just about any language. He's not lost. Indeed, he's discovered in translation. There are Russians convinced Shakespeare was, in fact, truth to tell, a Russian. Really a Russian. Ditto Germans, so enthusiastic about the bard, they can't believe he wrote in any other tongue but theirs. That doesn't mean putting the 400-year-old texts of the greatest writer in our language into Greek and Bahasa and Japanese and Icelandic is easy. It's about as hard a task as translators face. Getting the meaning right is only a start, argues Daniel Hahn in his book, If This Be Magic, The Unlikely Art of Shakespeare in Translation. Translators, he says, have to find a way of making another language do precisely exactly what Shakespeare is doing, always, absolutely, all of the time. A translator himself, Daniel rather modestly defines what translators are on about as the peculiar alchemy of turning gold into gold. He's here for the Sydney Writers' Festival, and he joins me now in the studio. Daniel, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks so much, David. I'm so pleased to be here on Late Night Live.
Henry V's stirring words before the Battle of Agincourt. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. Now, what could be easier than translating that?
In one sense, that line is very straightforward. The meaning of it couldn't be easier to understand. We few, it means people who are us and limited to the people who are us, and there are not many of us. But one of the things that's difficult about it is that Shakespeare is able to do that in two syllables because English happens to allow you to construct this little phrase that is we few, and then we happy few, and then we band of brothers, and it all fits into a single metrical line. And so while it's not hard perhaps to think about conveying the meaning of that in another language, when you're translating, you're also thinking about the rhythm of it, and in this case, the economy of it. Trying to do we few in almost any other language without stretching it, you know, because you don't want Henry V to be twice as long as it is. Great play, though, in fact, of course it is.
Enough is enough.
And yeah, I don't think, you know, we love Hamlet, but you don't get to Act 5 of Hamlet and go, I wish there were a couple more hours of this.
Yep.
And so in that particular line that you mentioned, one of the issues is however simple the language, however straightforward you'd think it would be to convey the meaning, you also have the challenge of economy. How do you do something that Shakespeare does because English works very well with monosyllables. If you're trying to do that in Portuguese, you're going to be in trouble.
But another thing Shakespeare is doing there is a monarch speaking plainly, which is so beautiful. Now, how do you do that in another language?
Well, that's the other thing, that so much of the time, I think also people assume somehow that Shakespeare is always going to be grand and flashy and flowery and poetic and, you know, big words. And actually, it's incredibly striking how often there are moments like that where when it comes down to the thing that's important, we're talking in really plain language, whether it is a monarch who is actually not, you know, using massive fancy words to talk to the troops, or example I love, which is the end of King Lear, which is just like one of the great moments of drama. King Lear wanders on stage with his dead daughter, and he doesn't talk in big, dramatic, you know, theatre words. He says, why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life, and thou no breath at all? Those are all monosyllables. They're all really simple words, like English, you know, an early English learner would know those words. But actually, the simplicity of them and the monosyllabic nature of them is part of the point. For a translator, that's part of the challenge.
But this shifting from voice to voice, which you describe so often and so beautifully in the book, also includes the shift in English from Latinate English to Anglo-Saxon English. And the book reminds us that, well, there are these two fundamental Englishes that we deal with all the time. And Shakespeare's choices matter, don't they?
They absolutely do matter. And Shakespeare, as a great writer, this is not a new or controversial opinion, I think. Shakespeare is a very great writer.
I'm going to tear you to pieces on this.
Go on, yes, go on. Bring it on. My contention is, you know, Shakespeare's pretty good. And one of the things that means is that he's using all the resources the language has. And he's doing things because English allows them. So English has, as you say, the two strands, basically two strands of vocabulary, you know, the Latinate and the kind of Anglo-Saxon and Germanic. And when he's using one rather than another, there is a significance to this. You have characters that will use a loftier language and move to a simpler language, which is to say, usually from Latin to Anglo-Saxon, or vice versa. They will jump between them in a speech to indicate something. And if you're translating into a language which doesn't have these two strands, you have to figure out, what is it I can do in Turkish? Well, if you're translating into Turkish, you might think, as Emily Ayhan, a Turkish translator, does, maybe I'll use more Ottoman words for the moment where Queen Margaret and Richard III is using more sort of heightened Latin language. But you have to use what is available to you. You can't, if you're translating into Italian, have a mix of Anglo-Saxon and Latin words if all of your words are Latin words.
And then, I mean, the hazards are so extraordinary. Then there's the business of punning. Now, Shakespeare puns all the time, doesn't he? Now is this glorious winter.
Now is the winter of our discontent
made glorious summer. Thank you for the correction. Yes. By this son of York. Right. Now, again, it seems pretty straightforward, but as you point out, it's full of difficulties for translation.
So just within that opening, now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York. If you were looking on the page, you could tell whether I was reading the word son, S-U-N, or the word son, S-O-N. When I'm saying the word to you, you have no way of knowing. If you're listening to the word on the stage, you have no way of knowing. Both of those words make sense in the context of a speech that is about winter turning to summer because of the sun, but it's also the son of York who's doing this, who is the son of the House of York, who is the new king who's making this change. And so when you're a translator, one of the things you have to figure out is, how am I going to make my language, using similar moving parts, if you like, create the effect that Shakespeare is having because English, again, happens to allow them. That one example, actually, because I talked to so many translators around the world who are working on Shakespeare and asked them to kind of explain what I thought were insoluble problems.
These interviews are the book.
Absolutely.
These conversations with translators.
Absolutely. A lot of the book is kind of based around, you know, conversations I had with people in all around the world. It was a huge pleasure and privilege talking to people who were really wrestling with these things.
But so a lot you get of them, these scenes, ladies and gentlemen, of Daniel in Istanbul waiting for a performance of King Lear to begin, or this wonderful, or in New Zealand, waiting for a performance in Maori to begin. Anywhere, really.
Yes, it was an amazing thing. I mean, I was just kind of sort of opportunistic. I was working on this book on and off for a couple of years, and I was traveling often for other kinds of work. But anywhere I went, as you said in your introduction, Shakespeare's always on somewhere, and Shakespeare's being translated somewhere. And so I happened to be in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I happened to be in Sofia, Bulgaria, for other reasons. And while I was there, of course, I'm going to sit down with a translator and talk about puns and iambic pentameter.
And while you're there, you're going to go and watch a performance of Shakespeare in a language that you have no clue about. And enjoy yourself.
Very often. And actually, it was interesting. There were sometimes, I mean, I saw a few performances of Twelfth Night, which is the play I know best, probably. And I saw that in Portuguese in Portugal, Portuguese is a language I know well. I also saw it in Budapest, in Hungarian, which is a language I know not at all. But I also saw, you know, footage of a Te Reo Māori translation production of Troilus and Cressida, which is a play I don't know at all. And you have a quite an interesting sense of, I feel like you notice different things. When I'm not distracted by, as it were, distracted by the meaning, which we often are when we're reading, I find myself noticing sound patterns and rhythms and, you know, all sorts of other things that are happening in the writing, which I think it's easy to disregard if the meaning is the thing that you kind of hook onto, which is what we normally do when we're reading or listening to language.
But you say that the translator's job is firstly to get into the guts of a work, to know it intimately, to see every little, I mean, it's an expression you use often, moving part, every little moving part, and to revere Shakespeare, but on the other hand, be willing to be brutally dismissive of Shakespeare when necessary. But how do you make those choices? Or how do translators make those choices?
I think you have to be, in one sense, dismissive when necessary, but it is always necessary in the sense that you're going to have to get rid of all of it. I mean, there's this really peculiar paradox that you're going to, I mean, the way I think of it is when I'm translating a novel, which is what I normally do, my aim is to make a novel that is absolutely identical to the other novel, except for all the words. Apart from the words, I want all of the properties to be the same. I want the rhythm and the voice and the textures and the tones and the humor and all those things to be the same. But I have to do it with 75,000 entirely changed words. I'm not tinkering. I'm throwing away all the words and starting again. And so there is, as you suggest, there's this kind of weird paradox, I think, in what translators are doing, that you're starting from an assumption that everything about this play I want to keep, every little twitch in the meter, every little funny detail of, you know, a syllabic pattern or whatever. I want to preserve all of those things. However, I have to start with a blank page and a completely new set of words, and then build something that has the same properties, that has the same effect, but they are not the same 25,000 words Shakespeare wrote. They are a completely different set of 25,000 Swahili words or Tamil words or Italian words.
And maybe if Mr. Shakespeare was absolutely regular in what he did, stuck absolutely to iambic pentameter, it would be an easier task. But, as you point out, his texts are full of irregularities, full of little things that break the rules. And you have to decide, or translators have to decide, whether those irregularities matter. What's your general view on irregularities? Do you go where Shakespeare went?
I think you have to work on the assumption that that most of what he's doing is there for a reason. Actually, if he were writing absolutely regular iambic pentameter all the way through the plays would be infinitely less interesting. They'd be dull. They would be, you know, they'd be less good. But actually, when there is a little kind of twitch, when there is a syllable that's inverted, when there is a line that's only 9 syllables and there's something missing, or there's an 11-syllable line with an extra beat on the end, there is a reason for that. You don't have that sense of Shakespeare of it kind of going regularly de-dum, 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 de-dum for 3.5 hours, which would be incredibly hard to get purchase on. So what you have is, as a translator, you have to notice every little irregularity, think about what the effect of that is, and then think about, well, how do I then replicate that in Danish, which is a completely different language. So when Hamlet comes on stage, he's at the battlements of his castle, Elsinore Castle, and he's been speaking fairly regularly in iambic pentameter, de-dum, 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 and then he sees his father's ghost, and his line is, angels and ministers of grace defend us. He doesn't say angelic ministers of grace, he says angels. So the first syllable is stressed really hard, and it's a way of Shakespeare giving an actor, without, you don't have to think about it as an actor, you can't help injecting a bit of urgency into that. Shakespeare does this all the time. Gallop apace,
urgency.
You file it fiery-footed steeds, or look to your house, your daughter, and your... That he often does this, the first syllable.
Now is the winter of our discontent.
Now is the winter of our discontent. And so as a translator, if you are translating that as an absolutely regular iambic line, you'll lose something. You're going to be giving your actor one fewer clue for what to do with that line.
Because that's what you argue through the book, that what Shakespeare is doing here is providing clues to actors, and the translator has to work out what Shakespeare wants the actor to do.
Absolutely. The translator wants their actor to have the same material to work with as the English-speaking actor does when they're working with Shakespeare. When Antony and Julius Caesar says, pardon me, thou bleeding piece of earth, that I am making gentle with these butchers. That word butchers is a really, you know, harsh, angry sort of word. He doesn't say these enemies, which means something bad, but it's quite a soft sounding word. And so if you're a translator, you want Antony to have a word that is kind of spittable in the way that butchers is a spittable kind of word.
And do other languages provide that?
And some do. I mean, you might have to decide, actually, the meaning is not the most important thing. I might translate it as something that means something slightly different in order to give the actor a thing that they can really show their contempt with just because of the particular, you know, clustering of consonant sounds in it. You know, you're giving an actor something to do. And again, the actor doesn't have to think, wait a second, there are some consonants in here. I must remember to spit this one. As these words are embodied by the actor, as these words that come through the actor's body, through the actor's mouth and their breath, this is the sound that comes out, butchers. And it's a horrible sound. And if you are a translator in Poland, you want an actor stepping onto the stage in Warsaw to be given something that allows them or obliges them even to use that word in the same way that we say butchers on the English-speaking stage.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Daniel Hahn, who is the author of If This Be Magic, The Unlikely Art of Shakespeare in Translation. Now, Daniel, you are not a purist when it comes to Shakespeare. You're quite happy, within certain constraints, to see Shakespeare's English translated into today's English. But what are the rules for that?
I'm interested in any translation that's attempting to create a kind of coherent new language for a play, which could be translated into contemporary hip-hop, like some productions I've seen, or translated into Polish, or translated into ballet. I'm very happy with all of those things. I adore West Side Story, which is a great translation of Romeo and Juliet into Bernstein music and Sondheim words and orchestra and voice and, you know, and dance. The thing that I find sort of disappointing, I suppose, are those things that purport to be translations that are really focused only on the meaning, that are essentially simplifications, that are saying, we're just going to make it easier for you to understand this, we're going to tell you what this thing means, and that feels like it's always a diminishment somehow. You're getting the gist, but the gist is only about the meaning. I think the occasional, you know, directors and dramaturgs will swap out occasional words, which doesn't make me particularly twitchy. I mean, I feel it'd be hard to make the case that I wouldn't want to swap out any words if I am happy to replace all of the words with Tamil words. So, you know, to complain about three or four English words would be, I think, hypocritical. But I do think there's a difference between those, let's call them translations, that try to find a new language for something, a new language for Shakespeare play. So a hip-hop Romeo and Juliet I saw, which was set in South London and was very different from the play in some ways, but it was coherent and it was dynamic. It was in a particular language. And it was attuned to rhythm and attuned to poetry and sound and all those things that I think are really important in Shakespeare. And I was infinitely more interested in that than in a sort of, you know, Romeo and Juliet for idiots, which you can buy, which is just a way of stripping out anything that isn't the clearest conveying of meaning. Because meaning is one of the things that translators are interested in, but there are 99 other things, and meaning is,
as you keep saying, meaning is not enough.
It's not enough. It's not. I mean, I think there are easier ways, like there are more efficient ways of telling the story of Romeo and Juliet than doing it in five acts with, you know, verse and prose and puns and whatever. But the richness of it comes from the complexity, which comes from sound and comes from all kinds of things. One could paraphrase it quickly. You know, if you're in a hurry to get the gist of it.
Like, the gist, yes.
Use that,
but that's
word
just
lot.
The gist.
But that's not the point. That you don't go just in order to find out if they die at the end, because you can do that on Wikipedia really quickly and save yourself some time. There is something in the substance. There's something in the material of the play.
And the experience of sitting there for that time as well.
And having
time has a role here.
Absolutely. And having a story told to you, especially if it's, you know, you're in the theater, in the room, in real time with people telling you a story, and you can see the breath almost.
Daniel, it struck me reading the book that there are parts of Shakespeare that have dated more than other parts.
Right.
And it's obviously a big problem for translators, but the jokes seem to have dated most. Is that your view?
It's certainly true that some of the jokes have dated quite a lot in 400 years, which I think is fair and unsurprising. Often things get, as it were, undated in translation, though. Often what happens is a translator is trying to make a joke work.
Mm.
And so what they're doing is they're figuring out, you know, what are the moving parts that go into this joke and constructing something equivalent. But it means that essentially what they're giving their audience is not the same as we get watching Shakespeare in English today, but something closer to watching Shakespeare in English at the Globe in 1599, watching Julius Caesar in September 1599. So often the jokes will be newer, the jokes will be fresher in translation, they'll be much closer to what an audience would have experienced 400 years ago. And there are lots of things that I feel, and the more I talk to translators, the more I found there's places where Shakespeare is kind of revived somehow in translation. All the things that are a little bit further away from us, the language which is in some cases a little bit hard to grasp, or the jokes or whatever it might be, even cultural references, just they're nudged just slightly closer to their audience when it is reconstructed for that audience in Italy today.
They're having a better time than us. It's outrageous.
Oh, absolutely.
Outrageous.
Without question, they have a better time than us. I mean, I would give one just really quick example. There's a scene in Merry Wives of Windsor where there is a Latin lesson on stage, which is almost always cut. I've seen Merry Wives of Windsor many times. I'm not sure I've ever seen that scene actually played, because it's basically full of jokes that are very hard to understand now without a huge amount of explanation. And you can understand it on, you know, in a printed edition because you have footnotes, but on stage you can't say, ladies and gentlemen, let me just explain this joke to you, hang on a second. But you can, as Jean-Michel Debras, French translator, did, build a scene that has equivalent jokes that are very funny. He thought, well, what are the what are the words that when I was learning French, Latin as a schoolboy made me laugh because they sounded like rude French words. He made a list of all those and he built a scene around them, which is kind of what Shakespeare was doing, except Shakespeare's jokes need a lot of sort of extra processing for us to understand them 400 years on. Jean Michel's jokes are funny first thing, you know, first time you see them on stage in Paris, they're funny today.
Mm. The English language also presents challenges because we use plain words which other languages break down into multiple meanings. The word you, Y-O-U, you, plain. The word love, plain. How do you translate these plain, common words and give them all of the nuances of meaning that Shakespeare gave them?
It's interesting because on the one hand, you could say that on the one hand, it's a benefit to have a word that encompasses a kind of huge range of meanings. So I can say, I would use the love, you know, the word love. I love ice cream. Also, my family. Also, Shakespeare. In very different ways. Really love ice cream, but differently, right? And Shakespeare, because English allows it, takes advantage of the fact that love covers lots of different things. And love is different parts of speech. Love is a noun. So there's a line in Richard III about that for thy love did kill thy love. The first love, for thy love, meaning in order that you will love me, did kill thy love, who is the person you love. That's one word being used in two really different ways. You can't do that in another language or most other languages, but you can sort of take advantage of the opposite. You can be much more precise in some other languages. We can testify much more precisely when a character says they love another character. If you want to in another language, it's much easier to be precise. Of course, it depends language to language, but you can be precise because you have so many different words to choose from.
If a translator has done his or her work, changed every bloody word, and still put Shakespeare on the stage in India or Iceland, why does it work? Why does it work regardless of the culture? Or indeed, does it work regardless of the culture?
I think much of it does. I think most of Shakespeare travels incredibly well. And the reason is partly, I mean, I suppose this is simplifying it, but partly it's that thing that literature always does, good literature or good art, which is you get that sense of something universal, something we can all relate to, because what's being created is incredibly specific. So what he does, you know, there are lots of death scenes in Shakespeare and no two people die the same way, because in reality, no two people die the same way. King Lear dies and Hamlet dies and they're completely different things that are happening to them. One of them is trying to say a few last words. One of them is struggling to breathe because there's, you know, the button on his shirt is too tight. And Shakespeare's doing this partly also because he is writing for actors. He needs to give actors something to do, you know, and it's much easier to act a precise thing than to die in a generic way, which is not a human experience. And so the precision, which comes from thinking about the character and also from using language in that incredibly detailed way where you're aware of the working of every syllable, is, again, it's this funny paradox of that is what makes it easy to relate to. We believe in this universal thing, not because it's vague, not because, well, love is love everywhere and Romeo and Juliet is the same as Troilus and Cressida or whoever, but because it's really particular, and that is a thing we recognise, I think.
Daniel, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
I've been talking to Daniel Hahn, author of If This Be Magic, The Unlikely Art of Shakespeare in Translation, published by Allen & Unwin. And Daniel is out here to appear at the Sydney Writers' Festival. And that's the show. On our next, Bruce Shapiro is back to make sense once more of the lies, cruelty and confusion of our closest ally, the United States of America. Such odd people. And we're talking to John Safran about this country's strange appetite for censorship, which he looks at in his new film, Shut Your Big Fat Mouth, John Safran.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.